So last time I was in the middle of a calculation, which was trying to figure out the equations of motion, the collision terms and the equations of motion for fluids in the universe that arise as a result of Thomson scattering. So it's easiest to do the calculation and forget about the expansion of the universe, do the calculation in normal coordinates in the electron rest frame, and then translate the result into at perturbed FRW coordinates. So in that rest frame, it looks like we have a bunch of baryons sitting at rest. There's a photon fluid that has some bulk velocity vi in the electron rest frame. And the photons also have some energy density rho. And a gas of photons, we found last time, a gas of photons with energy density rho gamma and bulk velocity v gamma has momentum density 4/3 rho gamma v gamma. So a single photon from this expression for the differential cross section, a single photon with incoming momentum p. Incoming momentum, p. Transfers momentum to the baryon fluid. At the following rate, so let's write this as an expression for the change in the baryon momentum density. Maybe for notational consistency, I should write the momentum density as pi b. So that is the probability. So I multiply the cross section by the electron density to get the number of collisions per unit time. And then to get the energy, the momentum transfer, I want to integrate the cross section over solid angles. So I put this cross section here. And then the transferred momentum, if the photon comes out at angle theta, is 1 minus cosine theta times the momentum that the photon had coming in. I write this p initial. Let's make this a vector. If you do this integral, you just get sigma t. The only property of the, so this just comes out to be sigma t times p initial. The cross section is normalized so that its integral over solid angle is sigma t. And then this factor doesn't change the result because the cosine gives an odd function of cosine theta, which integrates to zero. So I just can keep the one. If I were going beyond the perfect fluid approximation so that I needed to keep track of like the anisotropic stress energy imparted to the electrons as a result of the collision, then the detailed form of this cross section would actually matter. So what I'm looking for, so that's the momentum per unit time transferred to the baryon fluid per photon. And so what I actually want to compute is this, which is the momentum per unit volume per unit time. And so I would just multiply, if a single photon transfers momentum at this rate, to get the total momentum transferred per unit volume, I just multiply by the I just change this p to the momentum density of the fluid. This with an upper index. And that's where this factor of 4/3 comes in. You get that 4/3 times the bulk velocity. is what you get when you sum up the momenta, average the momenta of all the photons in the fluid. So this is the spatial part of the stress energy divergence, the momentum transferred per unit time. And because there's no energy transfer in Thompson scattering is elastic. Well, this is going to be zero. This is actually true because the energy per photon is in the electron rest frame is much less than the electron mass. Let's say since P gamma is much less than an electron. Okay, so this is the result in the normal coordinates in the electron rest frame, this tensor is equal to 0, 4/3 sigma t n e v gamma. We just, to translate it into an arbitrary frame, we just want to recognize, we want to recognize this as some tensor in this coordinate system. And if we can replace it by something tensorial, then the equation will be true in all frames. That's generally a good strategy for translating from one frame to another in GR. And so this is easy to do here because you can just use the this expression for the bulk, these expressions for the bulk velocities. So if I take 4/3 sigma t n e times the rho gamma. Oh, I lost the rho gamma somewhere. It was there, but not here. So I can just write the VI gamma as UI gamma minus UIB. That's all I need to do to make it tensorial. Should have been a new. This is something that's true in all frames. In particular, the perturbed FRW frame where the velocity of each fluid, the four velocity of each fluid is, there's always this one minus A, where A is the perturbation to the time-time part of the metric to make the square of this come up to minus one times A to the minus 1 V. So in the perturbed FRW frame, we deduce this. We found the change in four momentum per unit time per unit volume imparted to the baryon fluid. It's just going to be 0, comma 4/3 sigma t and e rho gamma. It's an a to the minus 1. And then the relative velocity, the velocity of the photons minus the velocity of the baryons. This relative velocity is gauge invariant. Okay, and then the divergence of the photon stress energy tensor just has to be the negative of this in order to satisfy overall stress energy conservation. Okay, so now I know what to put on the right-hand side to get the equations of motion for the fluids. So you remember from last time, we wrote out the equations of motions for the fluids look schematically like this. And this can be calculated in terms of the stress energy of the fluids and the components of the metric just by expanding out Christoffel symbols. And now we know what collision term to put on the right here from Thompson scattering. So if you plug in what we had before on the left-hand side and the right-hand side, you'll get these equations of motion. I'm just plugging in last time we had the left-hand side written out as a general formula for each fluid with the equation of state Wj of a fluid appearing. So I'm specializing those equations of state to being W equals zero for the baryons and cold dark matter and W equals 1/3 for the photons. So you get these equations. There's this factor of 4/3 that converts between velocity and momentum that sort of pops up in a lot of places. Then VIC minus VIC dot. So far I haven't fixed a gauge, but I'll make a convenient choice in a second to get rid of like these B's. I'm putting okay. So these are the equations of motion that we're going to be integrating, plus the Einstein equations, which give equations of motion for the metric. So these look like the equations of motion for the deltas just look like continuity equations that say that if the divergence is positive, if there's a net outflow, then the derivative of the overdensity decreases. Plus this sort of GR surprise, this derivative of a metric component, which is maybe a little tricky to interpret. And then on the right-hand sides, we have Navier-Stokes-like equations that include, you know, a term like this is a redshifting term. It just says that the velocities want to redshift down as 1 over a. And then a term like this is a pressure term. So this is missing in the cold dark matter and baryon equations of motion. Oh, I don't have to be here. So this says that if I have an overdensity of photons, then it wants to exert pressure. It wants to start the velocity moving in the direction of minus the gradient. It exerts a force proportional to minus the gradient of the overdensity. So it's trying to push photons out of overdensities. So that's a pressure term, and it means that the equations of motion of the photons will kind of look like sound waves that propagate. And then on the right-hand side, so this is just a term that will look kind of like schematically like minus gradient of phi, where phi is a gravitational potential. So this is just gravity pushing particles around. And these are collision terms, which are just trying to, if scattering is efficient, if sigma t is large, then it's just trying to set the relative velocities of the baryons and photons equal to each other. So there's just kind of like a drag term that tries to lock them to the same velocity. One little calculation we can do. Is we can try to figure out how efficient that scattering is. So this function NE, I'm using NE to denote the physical, not co-moving density of free electrons. So that goes to zero at recombination at a redshift of around 1,000. If you were integrating these equations numerically, you could either just put in some, you know, ad hoc reionization history, which goes from 0 to 1 near a redshift of 1,000, or maybe use something like the Saha equation, which just expresses thermodynamic equilibrium to get some more realistic curve here. I hope not. Which two terms?
Like the four thirds stuff, sigma t and e, and there is a fraction of densities, and the last one there is no fraction of densities. It has different units, right?
Sorry, which two terms are you comparing, this term and this term?
The one above. No, like the one that you put in it and the one right above that one.
Yeah, you're right. I think there should be no rho gamma here. Yeah, thank you. Let me just double check that. Yeah, I think that's right. I have it wrong in my notes. Thanks. Okay. So to see how important the scattering term is at recombination, we can compare the scattering rate. This is just number of scatterings per unit time. This is like the time scale for the scattering term in the equations setting the relative velocities equal to the Hubble rate, which is h. Which is sort of the time scale of cosmological evolution. It's like the time scale for these other terms in the equations evolving the baryons and the photons independently. So during matter domination, I put in the numbers. It's easy to put in the numbers and compare these time scales. I put in the numbers and got this is like 1.4 times 10 to the minus 4. Choosing some cosmological units, I'll do gigayears to the minus 1. That's 8 to the minus 3. And h is 1.4 times 10 to the minus 2. Minus 1. Minus 3. So at a equals 1, the Hubble rate is larger. So the scattering is inefficient. And that is actually the reason why we can see the CMB. We know that the universe is transparent at a redshift of above 6 or so, or more like 8, I think. Transparent above a redshift of 8 or so, and ionized below that. And so the fact that the scattering rate is low at low redshift compared to Hubble means that photons can make it out. The probability of a scatter or the optical depth is around 0.07. But at recombination, if A is 1,000, then this number is larger by a factor of, it looks like 10 to the 2.5. So scattering is much, and it just becomes more efficient relative to H at higher redshifts. So at recombination, scattering is very efficient. And what that's going to end up meaning is that these two fluids are sort of locked together as a single fluid before recombination. Their relative velocities are always equal, and that'll force a certain proportionality between delta B and delta gamma that we'll work out later. So before recombination, the universe sort of behaves as two fluids, a cold dark matter fluid and a coupled baryon photon fluid. And then what happens after recombination is that baryons, after recombination, now the scattering is turned off in the equations. So the baryons and the cold dark matter behave identically. They're both just non-relativistic, non-interacting particles. So after recombination, at least in this approximation, whether we say a particle is a dark matter particle or a baryon is just the label that we attach. The equations of motion don't care. And so after recombination, it's also true that the universe behaves as a sum of two different fluids, one of which is a photon fluid, that's the CMB. The CMB is the photon fluid. And the other is a combined cold dark matter plus baryon fluid. Of course, something interesting happens at recombination where fluctuations in the pre-recombination photon baryon fluids sort of convert themselves to fluctuations in the post-recombination cold dark matter plus baryon fluid. All right. Now, I want to do one more thing to the equations, which is to fix a gauge and switch to SVT notation. Switch to Fourier space plus SVT notation. So an intuitive choice, the choice I'm going to make is Newtonian gauge, which is very convenient for understanding the physics in an intuitive way. It is not so convenient for numerical integration. It is numerically unstable at early times. I'll explain why when we get more equations on the board. So in SVT notation, I'm going to take the Newtonian gauge to be this. You'll remember there was a longitudinal or helicity zero part of B. That's going to get rid of the b's in the equations, a longitudinal part of h, and a mixed with helicity 0, and a mixed part of h with hij with helicity 1. I'm not setting to 0 the trace part of h. That's going to be a dynamical quantity. So this is in SVT notation. Before I write down, I'm going to translate all the equations of motion and write down Einstein's equation in this gauge. But before I do that, I want to finally state what the initial conditions are and how they're related to inflation. I've been waving my hands at this for a few lectures. So by a theorem due to Weinberg that we'll talk about probably tomorrow, in the Newtonian gauge, single field inflation always produces a specific set of initial conditions. So in Newtonian gauge, the initial conditions are as follows. The density fluctuation in each fluid is Wj zeta. The velocity fluctuation in each fluid is given by this. Let's see, I have it in my notes. Let me write it slightly. I'm going to try to write it slightly. I think it's more intuitive to write it Well, no, I'll keep it the way I have it in the notes. So the velocity fluctuations are zero at early times, but I'm going to write sort of the leading term in conformal time tau. For numerical integration, you can take them to be zero initially. But just for fun, I'll write the leading term. The curl component, the helicity plus or minus one component of V, is zero. And then in the metric, we have the following fluctuations. So the components of the metric in the Newtonian gauge, we have a component A, which is equal to minus 2/3 zeta. There's a trace part of the metric, which is turns out to be 2/3 zeta. And the diagonal part of the curl part of B is zero. And the gravity wave part of the spatial metric, the completely transverse part, is the same as at the end of inflation. In our discussion of inflation, we had a gravity wave sector where these modes are constant at late times. They get frozen in, and they just survive until the beginning of the radiation-dominated universe. So I'll show how to derive these formulas a little later. For now, the point I want to make is just that there are formulas that connect the final conditions at the end of inflation with the initial conditions that we're going to be evolving for purposes of talking about CMB and large-scale structure. One comment here is that all the species have the same initial velocity. There are no relative velocities in the initial conditions. Okay. So then we just have to write down. Let's write down Einstein equations in the Newtonian gauge. Use SVT notation. So in helicity zero, we have this set of equations. They're not particularly simple looking just yet. Let me just remind you that my notation in the SVT notation in the SVT decomposition of H, HT was the trace part, which is 1/3 the trace of the spatial part of the metric. In general, we only need, once you fix a gauge, you'll only need two Einstein equations, since there are four, but two of them will always be redundant with the conservation of stress energy. But here, it's convenient, even though it's convenient to keep three, even though one of these can be derived from the other two. Okay, and then there's a helicity one equation, which says that, let me write that down for completeness. This is the equation that applies to the components of the vectors perpendicular to their Fourier wave number. And then there's a helicity two equation, which is this. So this is just what you get if you take specialized Einstein's equations to the Newtonian gauge and go to Fourier space and then do the SVT decomposition. I won't work it out, but it's pretty straightforward. All right, so we can start with to interpret these equations a little bit. So at helicity, starting with helicity 2, there are no dynamical degrees of freedom in the fluids in helicity 2. The stress energy is equal to 0, or the anisotropic stress is equal to 0. So this equation just says that in our current set of approximations that gravity waves propagate through the universe with some wave equation of motion that doesn't depend on what the fluids are doing. We'll analyze this later, maybe. What it will turn out to happen is that the gravity waves are frozen by Hubble friction at early times and then decay as soon as their wavelength becomes superhorizon. So that they're very small today. If there are cosmological gravity waves today, they're very small and will be difficult to detect. They do produce an observable effect in the CMB polarization, which is where the tightest future constraints will come from, but we probably won't have time to talk about that. If they are seen in CMB polarization, then their predicted amplitudes on smaller scales, say solar system scales, are roughly in the right ballpark to be detected with like futuristic versions of LIGO. Like there's some concept for something called the Big Bang Observer, which is supposed to be like three satellites that orbit the Earth in a little triangle with lasers between them to act like a little LIGO-style interferometer on each leg of the triangle. So a very futuristic souped-up version of LIGO would be able to detect the cosmological gravity waves on small scales if we see them in the CMB. And helicity 1, so that's what's happening in helicity 2, which is sometimes called the tensor mode equations, but I like calling it helicity 2 better. At helicity 1, which is what are called vector modes, there's a nothing much going on. The adiabatic initial conditions say that both V perpendicular and B perpendicular are zero in the initial conditions. And then this linear differential equation won't generate them. And I think, am I missing a dot on the right-hand side? So they're just zero for all times. At helicity 0, of course, is where the action is. So the last Einstein equation just says, since the anisotropic stress is 0 for a perfect fluid, that A is equal to minus HT. In the Newtonian gauge, so there's only one potential, so to speak. And in the Newtonian gauge, it's conventional to call that phi. The letter A would work just as well, but everybody writes phi in Newtonian gauge. In gauge notational convention. And the first and second Einstein equations can be written as follows. After rearranging a little bit, phi is just given algebraically in terms of the stress energy. So this is like a GR version of Poisson's equation. So phi is non-dynamical. And it's also convenient. You can rearrange these equations to solve for phi and phi dot. To have this equation for phi dot, even though it's it is redundant, it does follow if you differentiate the first equation and use stress energy conservation. But it's convenient to have around. So in Newtonian gauge, it looks like there's the potential is instantaneously determined in terms of the stress energy fluctuations at a space-like distance. So it sort of doesn't look like GR. But the price you, and that's true in Newtonian gauge, but the price you pay is that you have these derivatives of the potential appearing in the equations of motion, which do end up preserving causality. It means that, you know, if I disturb a fluid, that disturbance just propagates out to the future light cone, but doesn't have any effect at space-like separations. This is kind of like the Coulomb gauge in electrodynamics, where it looks like at the level of the vector potential, that it's instantaneously determined by charges and currents. But in the Coulomb gauge, it turns out that things propagate along light cones. Okay. So if I gauge fix the... So I have this Poisson equation determining the potential. And then if I gauge fix the fluid equations of motion in Newtonian gauge, I get these equations, which finally at the end of all these calculations, these are the equations of motion for the universe that I'm going to be talking about for the next couple of lectures. Phi dot delta B dot A parallel 3 phi dot gamma time. Okay, so we've derived the equations of motion for some gravitating perfect fluids in an expanding universe with GR, with all GR terms there, plus Thompson scattering, trying to couple the baryons and photons together. So we're going to be playing with these equations for a while. So one thing to remember is that you know, the space derivatives and indices have been removed by going to Fourier space and switching to SVT notation. So just remember that when we talk about integrating these equations, we're talking about integrating one k mode at a time. The velocity looks like a scalar. It doesn't have any indices. We're just keeping track of the component of the velocity that is parallel to the Fourier wave number. Or that is to say, with my sign conventions, the velocity inflow. If the velocity and the density, if there's a density perturbation and a velocity perturbation, and they have the same phase and sign, then I'm talking about a, that means that there's some mode in the density and some, and the velocity is phased up to be an inflow. In the initial conditions, that's what happens. All the fluctuations are phased up, so to speak, where if you look back at the initial conditions, there'll be some, oh yeah, there. The initial density mode in the initial conditions will be some zeta mode with a random phase and amplitude, a Gaussian random phase and amplitude, times some positive number, 1 plus wj. And then the velocity looks like a negative number, a negative coefficient, times zeta, with this factor of tau. So what we have in the initial conditions is like a perfectly phased up velocity and density fluctuations so that the mode is kind of standing still in the initial conditions. And then as time goes by, it sort of develops an, I guess, an inflow to start reducing the amplitude of the mode. This phasing up of density and velocities is what we think is unique to distinctive of quantum mechanical production of the initial conditions. This doesn't happen for, say, defect models of the initial conditions, and that's why you don't end up with acoustic peaks in the CMB. Now, this system of equations, you can just throw on the computer. So one possible thing we could do at this point would be to just, I could just sort of distribute plots of what happens to these functions as a function of wave number and time. And you would see that, you know, the following phenomena occur. One comment that I should say is that I've phrased the differential equations as if you were evolving some specific realization of the initial conditions. But what we actually do is we start with, we set the initial zeta equal to 1. And then we evolve to some later time and get values of delta b and so on. And what you've actually computed then is the transfer function. Which just relates the value of the field in a specific realization to the initial curvature in that realization. And then an observable like the, well, let's say this is the matter. And then an observable like the matter power spectrum, which is something that we actually go out and measure, would just be the square of that transfer function times the power spectrum of zeta from inflation. So if we plot the matter power spectrum, this is something that I showed very briefly when I was showing some slides. Let me say it again. One thing that you will get if you just throw these equations on the computer and plot the matter power spectrum is you will find a power spectrum at late times, say at redshift 0, which is very suppressed at small k. It initially grows like k to the fourth. And it has a turnover at a particular scale, which turns out to be the size of the horizon AH. So 1 over AH is kind of a fundamental length scale in cosmology. It's the in co-moving distance, the size of the causal horizon. So it's the value of that scale evaluated at matter radiation equality. At the redshift when the density of matter and radiation were equal, which turns out to be at a redshift of about 3,000. So this is something that we'd like to explain. There's this turnover. This is at a scale of around 0.02 inverse megaparsecs. So this length scale, the reciprocal of KEQ, which is about 50 megaparsecs, is a really ubiquitous length scale in the late universe. It sort of determines, it's the only, well, aside from maybe you know about the baryon acoustic oscillations, which are little wiggles on top of this. Aside from that, it's sort of the only length scale in the late universe. If I ask a question like, if I take our CMB dipole, for example, it points in some particular direction. And if an observer in the next galaxy over were to measure their CMB dipole, they would find a correlated value. It points in nearly the same direction. Of course, if you go far away in the far away, enough in the universe, it would decorrelate. And the length scale where that happens is about 50 megaparsecs. So very loosely, because this power spectrum is falling so fast below 50 megaparsecs, uh, You could think of the late universe as sort of a bunch of 50 megaparsec cells, where fluctuations are highly correlated inside these cells, but decorrelate pretty fast as you go from 50 megaparsec chunk to 50 megaparsec chunk. Another thing we'd like to explain is that if I compare this matter power spectrum at two different redshifts, what I find is that the amplitudes are different, but there's no change in the shape. So this matter power spectrum is just proportional to, as a function of k and redshift, is equal to some function of a times some function of k. And I'd like to understand why that is. Another thing I'd like to understand is why in the at recombination, so let's say z of 1,000, if I plot something like the power spectrum of the baryons or the power spectrum of the photons, they're going to be the same since they're coupled together as a single fluid. Then I get a power spectrum with, let's say that I'm plotting the power spectrum of the photons. Then I get a power spectrum with wiggles. These wiggles are what turns out to generate the acoustic peaks in the CMB, because when you observe the CMB, more or less what you're seeing is the distribution of the photon density on the last scattering surface. The fact that this is so wiggly means that the CMB power spectrum is very bumpy. It has these very sharply defined acoustic peaks that we can get cosmological information out of. So all of these things, these basic phenomena, the existence of this scale in the late universe, the scaling as a function of time but not k, and acoustic features in power spectra involving baryons or photons are things that I'd like to, you'll see those empirically if you were just to throw these differential equations on the computer. But then in the next couple lectures, I want to go into the physics and explain why they're there. And the other thing I want to explain is where the initial conditions come from. Now, it'll be very helpful to keep in mind these equations don't have analytic, like true analytic solutions, but in various regimes, where only some of the terms are important, they can be solved analytically or partially solved analytically. So what we're going to do is just sort of develop a bunch of approximations with varying degrees of validity, regimes of validity, with enough overlap between the various regimes of validity that we can kind of put together the pieces of the puzzle and see what's going on. And it'll be sort of helpful to keep in mind the following picture. As a function of time, or let me say scale factor log A, there's this co-moving distance scale, 1 over AH, which evolves. So if I start the plot during inflation, this distance scale goes like 1 over A. When AH goes like 1 over AH goes as like 1 over A. Something important happened if I was evolving a mode with Fourier wave number k. When the wavelength of the mode crossed the horizon, when it went from being a wavelength which was subhorizon, smaller than AH, 1 over AH, to superhorizon, that's where the quantum mechanical fluctuation was generated. So before this, there was no fluctuation. And afterwards, there was some value of zeta that was sort of frozen in. Its equation of motion was zeta dot equals 0. This is the part of the physics that we've explored in detail. What happens is this mode becomes more and more superhorizon. And then there's an event, reheating, where we go from inflation to radiation domination. Then during radiation domination, H is going like a to the minus 2, so this curve starts to climb back up as 1 power of a. And then what'll happen is that the next event is the switch from radiation domination to matter domination. At matter domination, H starts to go like a to the minus 3 halves, so this curve sort of has a bend in it. It starts going like a to the 1 half. So let's call that. This is going to be reheating. This is matter radiation equality. And in between is radiation domination. And then the next event that happens is recombination. Which has no effect on the history on 1 over AH. The universe is still, the expansion history of the universe is still matter dominated, and recombination doesn't do anything, but the character of the equations changes a lot. So we keep climbing as a to the 1 half. And then what happens at late times, I'm going to put it far out so that I have more room to write things on the axis, is that the universe switches over to lambda domination. And during lambda domination, the equation of state is minus 1, same as inflation. So the curve starts to drop again. The peak here occurs, by the way, when the total equation of state of the universe is W equals minus 1/3, which happens at a redshift of something like 1.5. So it's already happened. We're sort of living here. And it'll be very important. So for our purposes where we're starting here with initial conditions that come from inflation, there's sort of three events. There's matter radiation equality, there's recombination, and there's the switch over to lambda domination. And in evolving a mode, it'll be very important where the inverse, where the wavelength, K inverse, falls on this plot. A mode that crosses the horizon during radiation domination evolves differently from a mode that crosses the horizon, say, well after recombination. Okay. So the first thing we're going to study, I'll save it for tomorrow because we've sort of reached the end of the hour. The behavior of the matter of the dark matter fluctuations. So first, we'll study behavior of dark matter fluctuations at late times. Meaning, after horizon crossing, or recombination, whichever comes last. In this regime, the equations simplify a lot, and we can solve them more or less exactly. Okay, so tomorrow we'll start off here, and then depending on how much time we have in the next couple of lectures, I'll cover more regimes where the equations can be understood analytically until we have sort of a complete picture of what's going on. Thanks.